You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today is at one and the same time one of the most familiar stories of Jesus' life and one of the least understood. And because I'm a goober this way, the differences in the gospel tellings of this episode have always irritated me. Plus, nobody even knows when it happened. For Mark, it happens on Monday. For Matthew and Luke, it happens on Sunday. And for John, you just plain need a time machine to figure out what he's talking about. More on that later. Plus, it doesn't rate getting its own day, like Palm Sunday, Monday, Thursday, Good Friday. Why not Madhouse Monday or Monday Mayhem? The event itself can also be a little uncomfortable for some people because this doesn't go with the whole gentle Jesus, meek and mild narrative. To think of Jesus losing his temper and trashing a place is disturbing. But setting all that aside, what does matter is that it happened at all. And like many of the other events of Holy Week, suggests a pretty sophisticated understanding of cause and effect on Jesus' part. He knows that his program, this conspiracy of love, will be seen by both the Roman occupiers and the subservient Jewish oligarchy that supports them as an existential threat to the status quo. He's already warned the disciples that he's going to be killed, but they just blow it off as Jesus' personality, you know, it tends toward the dramatic. The Palm Sunday entrance into Jerusalem has already, for different reasons, pushed the Romans and the Sadducees to the brink. The stage is set. Now all we need to set the inevitable in motion is just one little push.
Our words of wisdom are from Mark chapter 11, verses 15 through 17. Then they came to Jerusalem, and Jesus entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temples. He was teaching and saying,
"Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations'? But you have made it a den of robbers."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Around this time of year, a meme often makes its way around the internet that was inspired by today's text. Right? If we're serious about asking, what would Jesus do? Turning over a few tables and chasing people with a whip definitely needs to be in our repertoire. But we hesitate. We're not sure that that fits our picture. Our guide to conspiracy, Kurt Struckmeyer, says, if we take our spiritual blinders off for a moment, we could begin to see Jesus in a new light. Imagine him in the context of a struggle for social and economic equality similar to the struggles of Gandhi and Martin Luther King as they addressed their respective domination systems. Think about Jesus' speech in the Nazareth synagogue and imagine it as Jesus' "I have a dream" speech. "I have been anointed to bring good news to the poor, to bring release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to forgive all debt, and return the land to all of its original owners," which is essentially what he was calling for. Jesus was announcing a social revolution, an undeniable and clearly political threat to the status quo. And he was not naive. He knew that what he was calling for, even by means of nonviolent resistance, would mean the opposition of those who felt threatened by values that reflected God's priorities. In other words, the well-being of the poor, the hungry, and the weeping. He even went so far as to say out loud, "Woe to you who are rich." And before you deflect that woe to Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, remember, as far as the vast majority of the world is concerned, we are the rich, you and me. Now, if you're still resisting the idea that what Jesus was up to was creating a political movement, I invite you to read Luke 10. That's where Jesus went and did something that anyone involved in politics would recognize as straightforward grassroots organizing. Jesus gathered together a team of 82 operatives, 12 in leadership, and 70 who were sent out to the villages and towns of Galilee. Their job was to canvass the neighborhood and prepare for the coming political campaign tour on which Jesus was about to embark. The message they shared was one of economic justice and political reorganization. How would this be done? By creating compassionate communities that provided for each other's needs and responding when called upon to share their resources in the care of the widow, the orphan, and the stranger. Sound familiar? And just like candidates today, Jesus attended a lot of banquets. Here he was, homeless, no money, no food to offer, and certainly no banquet table, but he managed to pull together a crowd in every village and hamlet and celebrate with plenty of food for everyone. It was brilliant, really. Here you had people who were beaten down by fear and a sense of scarcity that had them looking at their neighbors with suspicion. And Jesus comes along and convinces them that the solution is to share what they have and work together for the betterment of all. In the simple act of getting people to share a meal, Jesus demonstrated the value of interconnectedness and the power of community. Suspicion and fear of scarcity evaporate. Jesus knew that people who are afraid are easy to manipulate. So through his actions of community building and including everybody, he was liberating people from those fears. He was liberating those who were captive to the system and making them less likely to be pushed around. But no amount of building support for his movement would be successful without directly addressing the power structure in Jerusalem. And that would not be easy. The Jews had already been producing a number of popular anti-Roman movements across the region, which were easily put down with threats and executions. But they, along with local religious leaders, the Sadducees, would have seen any destabilizing of the temple as an action against Roman order and their own economic interests. So, where Jesus' talk of love and empowerment may not have seemed very threatening, a direct confrontation of the hierarchical temple system in Jerusalem, where the rich and powerful held sway, get people's attention. Jesus knew that even the kind of pumped-up crowd that marched through the city on Palm Sunday wouldn't be a genuine threat to powers that were used to putting down fledgling uprisings. So like any community organizer worth their salt, Jesus understood his target audience. And when he got to Jerusalem, his target audience was no longer his disciples, who were largely clueless about what Jesus was up to anyway. But the elites at the top became his target audience. And Jesus knew how he could best get their attention. It's a variation of what we might call today pain point marketing. You know, watch any commercial or peruse any ad, and you'll find that marketers first identify a point of pain in your life, acne, shingles, student debt, and then they offer a solution, product A, B, or C, and voila, your pain is relieved. Jesus put a little different spin on it. Imagine getting a group of Sadducees and Roman bureaucrats together for a little focus group and ask them, What makes you feel stressed? What makes you worry? What makes you mad? What makes you afraid? What makes you squirm? What makes you feel insecure? What makes you lose sleep? And the answer is, across the board, somebody like Jesus stirring up trouble. So it must have been perfectly obvious to Jesus that if he wanted to get their attention, he needed to hit them where it hurt, disrupt the established order, interrupt a well-oiled economic machine, and threaten the status quo in general. Jesus intentionally agitated his audience. He pushed their buttons. He knew that in order to really get their attention, he had to hit them where it hurt. And in the case of the establishment, that was right in the pocketbook. Threatened to interrupt the cash flow into the elite's coffers, especially at the high season of Passover, and look out. So on the Monday morning after Palm Sunday, Jesus arrived at the temple and created a public disturbance right under the noses of the Sadducees and the Roman garrison of the Antonio Fortress. And not just any disturbance, but one that brought attention to the injustice being visited upon the people. Granted, it wouldn't do any real damage to the system, and the money changers themselves weren't evil. They were just pawns in a much bigger system that was exploiting regular folk. Jesus knew what everyone knew. The system was rigged against the regular folk and in favor of the wealthy elites and occupying Romans. So his overturning of the tables was symbolic of his opposition to a corrupt system. Why target the money changers? Because it was Passover, and Jews were coming to the temple from every corner of the known world to celebrate. But one could only pay the temple tax with the approved coinage of the temple. So money changers were required to exchange foreign currency into temple tokens at a profitable exchange rate, no doubt. But I don't think the low-level money changers or dove sellers were the target of Jesus' anger at all. Jesus was sending a message to those at the top levels of society who perpetuated a system of economic injustice. Like the righteously indignant actions of the prophets of old, Jesus' action on the Temple Mount was also a teaching, symbolically condemning not Judaism, which some have suggested, but of the corruption and injustice of the system manipulated to benefit the elites at the expense of the poor. Jesus was putting those who rob people of their land, their resources, and their livelihoods for their own benefit on notice. And from the events that were to follow the rest of the week, it's clear that both the Sadducees and the Romans understood Jesus' message very clearly. As I thought about applying this passage to life, the suggestion of literally turning over tables somewhere not only seems impractical, it doesn't jive with the majority of Jesus' other nonviolent teachings and actions. Plus, the gospel writers are totally scattershot on what they think Jesus' ultimate motive was. Hoping no one would notice the whole incident, Matthew even throws in Jesus healing some of the blind and lame as a distraction. And of course, as I've already mentioned, they couldn't even agree on what day it happened. Then in Mark, Matthew, and Luke, Jesus' ministry is only 1 year, and all three leave this episode to the last straw status in Jesus' arc of conflict with the authorities. John, on the other hand, who made up a completely different timeline with a different theology and a completely different Jesus than the Synoptic Gospels, has Jesus' ministry being 3 years. And then, instead of putting our cleansing of the temple incident at the very end, like everybody else, John puts it at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, a kind of poking the bear where Jesus irritates the authorities and then demonstrates a kind of taunting, come and get me attitude for the next 3 years. But regardless of whether something like this actually happened at the end of a one-year ministry or the beginning of a three-year ministry, one thing stands out in common. Jesus was not afraid to confront those who were exploiting, excluding, and doing harm to the least of these in the community. And that's something we need to take more seriously as a characteristic of those who claim to be followers of Jesus in today's world. So, with all that it implies, I'm guessing a good stream of thought for today would be to ask, what tables do you need to overturn? Think about it. What entrenched systems of exploitation or exclusion do you need to put your creativity and effort behind? What relationships do you need to reorder for the benefit of both yourself and others? What kind of institutional or cultural inertia do you need to stand up to and derail for the benefit of those who are otherwise unable to live lives of dignity and worth? And here's the biggie. Like Jesus, are you willing to face the consequences? As an institutional member of Valley Interfaith Project, the Fountains has had the chance to be involved in a number of actions and efforts that hold government and corporate interests accountable for the way they treat the poorest and voiceless members of our community. One of the founders of VIP's parent organization, the Industrial Areas Foundation, is the legendary Ernesto Cortez Jr. I'll always remember the first time I met Ernie. I'll admit I was a little starstruck. Here he was, a social justice rock star, surrounded by doting United Methodist clergy. And he kind of shook his head with disapproval. He then pointed his finger at us and said, "You know what's wrong with all you Methodists? You're too nice." Huh? Yeah, he's right. As a mostly white, middle-class bastion of the status quo, most Methodists have been anesthetized into inaction. We cruise along, assimilated into the role of a benevolent service organization, there to help in times of disaster. But out of fear of tainting our reputation for being nice, are hesitant to get in there and turn over a few tables. I really appreciate Richard and Donna tackling a cover of Turning Over Tables for our offertory this morning. Ever since I heard the Brilliance version of this song, the lyrics have resonated with me as a way to see Jesus' action on Madhouse Monday as a metaphor for what we need to be on about today. The lyrics remind us of what we've all experienced in our lives, especially in the last year. Fear runs deep, spreading like a virus. Hate is cheap. From afar, it costs you nothing. Sister, take my hand. Brother, we will stand. Open up your heart and find that love is turning over tables, breaking off chains. When I see you in the stranger, I'm no longer a slave. Turning over tables, tearing down walls, building up the bridges between us all. Wow, when I see Christ in the stranger, I'm no longer a slave. The chains of the status quo of division and suspicion no longer hold me back. I can turn that table over. I can break off that change. I can build up bridges between us all. So, what would Jesus do? Well, flipping over a few tables and chasing people out of their comfortable collusion with injustice is not out of the realm of possibilities. So this Holy Week, ask yourself, what tables do you need to overturn? The question is an important one, especially if you expect to be a full participant in Jesus' conspiracy of love. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.